Mulasa. So over the almost last 3 weeks, I've shared with you a number of meditation practices, and there will be more over the coming 5 weeks. And if you're not already feeling a little bit overwhelmed, you may very well feel that before the 8 weeks is over, and wondering, well, what to do with all the variety. And here's what I would suggest. And that is, there are 50 people here in the room, and then quite a number of others listening from afar. And as is said so often, kangla kangdu, and that is, the teachings are intended to train individuals according to their own predilections, abilities, inclinations, desires, right? And so it's not one size fits all, it's not one method that's good for everybody, but to give a variety of methods means that, you know, among them, then you test, you try them out, and see which ones work for you. When it comes to shamatha, that's very transparent. There's nothing mystical or strange about it. Does it work or not, right? Does it induce, bring forth greater sense of ease, stillness, and clarity? So straightforward. And whatever method works, or combination of methods, that's what you should focus on. And likewise, as we're moving into we'll have more variety in shamatha coming up through this chapter, and then we'll have the vipassana. You'll see even there, Kamachamadambuchi is giving different approaches, different nuance, and so on. Mahamudra tends to be homogenous, and yet teachers have their own different approaches, way of phrasing, and so forth. And so what I would suggest, really, already I've mentioned this to you and to a number of you one-on-one, and that is, number one, I think all of you without exception came here already with some type of meditative practice, and you are doing that, presumably because you find it helpful. So, bring whatever is helpful from your past, and then really be emphasizing from day to day, find for yourself kind of the three basic food groups within shamatha, one or methods. They just suit you. And again, if you can find that magic word, the magic word is not progress. The magic word is you enjoy it. You actually like doing the practice. That makes all the difference over the long term, you know. Progress, yeah, but progress you can't control. But if you can enter into a practice and find you're really enjoying doing it, that bodes well for the future. Right, so among the shamatha practices, you know, test, and then you may want to settle in on a regular basis. Okay, among the shamatha, I really want to emphasize every day this one, maybe a second one, balancing out. And then likewise, we have this whole food group of wisdom practices. There's vipassana. We already had a couple of methods there. We'll have more, but there's also contemplative reading, which is very much in the wisdom category, the wisdom group. So contemplative reading. And then, of course, there's the cultivation of the heart. The four immeasurables, the Avalokiteshvara, the Tonglen, the Bodhicitta, the Guru Yoga, the refuge, all of these are for the heart. So then choose, you know, just choose. But I would encourage you to choose, have a good sampling from each of the food groups so that you have balance and you're maintaining balance through these 8 weeks. So by the time we come to the end of the 8 weeks, my aspiration is that everybody here, I hope without exception, will leave with some confidence. All right, I'm a chef now. We had a nice 8 week cooking school, and I'm a chef, and I know how to cook up things when I'm home, and I know how to be flexible, to adapt to changing environment, not be rigid, not be complaining about environment, you know. In other words, a mature practitioner. So that's what I would suggest. So find something kind of regular, but let it be, have structure, and let it be flexible. That middle way, always a middle way. Then a very brief reminder, as I've mentioned before, this kind of like this central area right here, right next to the meditation hall and so forth, if we can just kind of a little reminder that let's let the baseline, the ground state here be silence, you know. So if you'd like to chat, of course I've never said no talking, but do honor, let's all honor other people who would really like to be in a quiet space, maintaining the flow of their mindful awareness, their practice, whatever it may be. So kind of really keeping that, keeping the silence here in this nuclear area here, this central area, and there's so much space around us to talk if we like to go for a walk and so on. So with that little preamble, what I'd like to do for the session, the next session, is a bit of review about the combination plate that I think I've referred to, but I'd like to do it once. For those people who are maybe still kind of feeling your way into the practice of settling the mind in this natural state, right? It's subtle, and it's also, by the very nature of the beast, by the very nature of the method, it does invite these flare-ups, these eruptions, these nyam and so forth, of emotions, memories, and all kinds of stuff. And so it tends to arouse the mind with kind of this. You never know what's coming up, so that already sets you a little bit, you know, destabilizes, like, what's next? And so that's very good, as I've mentioned before, this practice of settling the mind in its natural state is very good for sharpening the awareness, that vividness, to be able to discern, to identify briefer and briefer events, these little flickerings that just kind of flash in and flash out. And then also the qualitative vividness of subtle murmurings of the mind, movements of the mind. A subtle, it could be a desire also. So very good for that, but it can also make you a little bit hyper. If you're doing that a lot, make you very, very sensitive, hypersensitive, and therefore a bit fragile, right? And so for this, then, a very nice combination, which I will guide now with not a lot of words, because I think you know the basic material is balancing earth and wind. Earth and wind. The wind metaphor is one used by Dzogchen Lingpa, and it's as if you're facing into the wind of thoughts and emotions, memories, and so forth, facing into it, but like this beautiful image of the kestrel, like a hawk, a kestrel, facing into the wind, kiting into the wind. A beautiful image. You've all seen it, I'm sure. But where just with this very subtle movement of the wings and the tail feathers, the kestrel or the falcon, the hawk, remains stationary with respect to the ground, but ever sensitive, moment to moment, always fresh to the shifting currents, strong wind, light wind from the left, from the right, going upwards, going down, and just this slight adjustment, this great sensitivity and attentiveness to the present moment, remaining still, right? Awareness resting in its own place, but vibrant, clear, sharp, right? And so that's the wind part, and the ground, I think you already figured out, that's mindfulness of breathing. So we'll have, really, we're just going to break this into two halves, this 24-minute session. After settling body, speech, and mind, the first half, I invite you to go into mindfulness of breathing, emphasis on relaxation, emphasis on calming, soothing, quieting the mind, which means then, and again, to clearly demarcate this method from the next one, and that is when thoughts come up, you have no interest in them whatsoever. Whatever they are, interesting, dull, boring, happy, sad, virtuous, non-virtuous, no interest. Just whatever they come up, you just see them come up, release, release. Just all you have to do is see the head come up, release. So you really are clearly preferring silence, non-conceptuality, a flow of non-conceptual cognizance, clear preference, right? And you get there not by screaming at the mind to shut up, you know, tightening up, I will make you be quiet. If you don't stop crying, I'm going to give you something to cry about. Never heard of that? Oh, man. Not that. No, just releasing, you know, until really so the whole system kind of quiets down. And then segueing from that to then turning your full attention to the mind. And then whatever comes up is not so likely to catch you and carry you away. You know, when you first get some quiet, some serenity, some equilibrium, and from that, then you attend, okay, then something comes up, rather than going to a fire hydrant with a little cup and saying, I'd like a little bit of water, please. You know, 50 feet away. You see this little English lady. Some water, please. Okay. So please find a comfortable position right off the bat. You like to be supine, standing on your head, whatever you like. Settle the body in a posture of ease, of stillness, of vigilance. Soft eyes, soft face. And with this sense of utter and thorough release with every out-breath, settle your respiration in its natural rhythm. Settle your mind in stillness with a sense of ease and its own natural clarity. And choosing the method that you find most beneficial, but with an emphasis on the releasing into relaxation of ease and comfort, and the calming, the soothing, the quieting of the mind. Practice mindfulness of breathing for a little while, with or without counting, whatever you see to be most beneficial for yourself. and let your eyes be at least partially open. Let your awareness be still, but let the light illuminate the space of the mind, and observe especially those events arising, the thoughts, the appearances. Simply observe their nature as you've done before. And let's continue practicing in silence. Anasana. So let's return to the text. Yeah. Yeah, so here we are on top of page 66. The last verse that I read was from the Bodhicaryavatara, actually the fifth chapter, on introspection. In brief, this alone is the characteristic of introspection, the repeated investigation of the state of the body and mind. Then we continue. The root of shamatha is dhyana, so meditative stabilization is my translation I have used. Nowadays I just more stick with the Sanskrit. The root of shamatha is dhyana. So the meaning of the first scriptural collection of the sutras is that the discipline is training the mind. The first collection, of course, is the Vinaya of the three Pitikas, Vinaya, Sutta, Abhidhamma. So the first is the discipline is training the mind. Here there are four, as stated in the Jewel Ornament of Liberation. These are the four dhyanas. Okay? So where we're living, the whole field of our experience is said to be in the Kama Dhatu, the desire realm, and then beyond, more fundamental than that is the form realm, and more fundamental than that is the formless. But here's a brief synopsis from Gampopa's Tapatagin, or Jewel Ornament of Liberation, and so he summarizes them very briefly here. And I'm going to modify the translation just a bit to bring it up to my current understanding. There are the first, second, third, and fourth dhyanas. The first dhyana is endowed with investigation and analysis, Thopa Dan Chöpa in Tibetan. It's often in the Theravada tradition translated as applied and sustained thought, simply implying, again, I want to be very brief here, we could spend a lot of time on that one passage, but what is implied here is once you've achieved this first dhyana, the actual state of the first dhyana, which is just beyond the achievement of shamatha itself, and I'll explain that later, then the mind has this it has a number of qualities. It has a sense of well-being, it's blissful, it's single-pointed, and whenever you wish, you can use it analytically, conceptually, to engage in a coarse investigation and subtle analysis. In other words, it's a superb platform for vipassana. And in fact, when you might recall the story, I've cited it many times, when the Buddha's own life, after he'd gone through the 6 years of ascetic practice, some of you recall that, and he tried that, didn't work, he balanced out his body with the help of maybe an emanation of Tara, a young woman who got his health back on track, gave him some rice and curds. He rebalanced his health, regained his vitality, but then he was wondering, what shall I do now? Because he'd really kind of tried out everything and nothing worked in terms of really providing him with the liberation that he was seeking. And then you may recall he thought back to a time when he was a youth, sitting quietly under the rose apple tree while his father was out performing some farming ritual, and he spontaneously slipped into the first jhana. He just slipped into it. He was a prodigy. And then he described that, how it was blissful, it was serene, it was secluded from the senses, it was wholesome, and he simply enjoyed that, and then it kind of faded away, and he got back to his princely life, right? But it was he genuinely slipped into it and then slipped out again. And that was, who knows, maybe he was 10, 12, 13 years old. Now, at the age of 30, 35, he's finished 6 years of asceticism, austerities, and various types of exercises and so forth. Nothing worked. And then he recalled this experience of slipping spontaneously into the first jhana. He recalled that, and then the thought he described, the thought came to my mind, might that be the way to liberation? He posed that to himself, and the answer came back, yes, it is. So then he reaccomplished it. He reaccomplished the first jhana, and then sat under the Bodhi tree, and the rest is history. But that first jhana, it's an extremely useful one. It's quite special, because it's not zoned out. It's not blissed out. It's not abstracted out. It's extremely balanced, marvelously mindful, clear, luminous, still, real sense of well-being and joy, but not overwhelming joy, just very, very pleasant. But very importantly, you have right on tap, at your fingertips, the ability to investigate and analyze. In other words, you can practice vipassana, right? In the higher state, you can't, because you don't have, the mind becomes so subtle, you cannot arouse it to investigation and analysis. So the first jhana turns out to be quite a big deal. So that's the first one. The second one, in the second one you've gone to, it's all an issue of tarak, taraki kebar, going from the coarse to the subtle. So in the second dhyana, you've released, you've made your mind so subtle that kind of the, how do you say, the coarser functions of investigation and analysis, they fall away. And so your mind now is still imbued with a single-pointedness, of course, a sense of well-being and a sense of bliss or joy. That's in the second dhyana. Here, what does it say? The second dhyana is endowed with pleasure. Pleasure is fine, joy is good, but also it's a sense of well-being. It's really sukha. Sukha is a sense of well-being. Sukha and deva tangawa nikayore, samdhinivalayore. And so, but then you keep on going subtler. So this is simply a path of going from subtle to subtler to subtler. You move to the third stabilization, or third jhana, and now that sense of joy that has a kind of a sharp edge to it, joy or bliss, that's smoothed out. It's gone. And there simply lingers a sense of well-being or sukha. Sukha. That's the third jhana. But then you keep on going subtler, and you find even sukha is quietly perturbing, gives us kind of a subtle agitation, and you release even sukha, you release even a sense of well-being, and you go into just pure, even equanimity. No suffering, of course, but no joy, no pleasure, just even, and you achieve the perfection of mindfulness. And that's when you can go into samadhi, and you can stay for day after day after day, for weeks, with no breathing. That's the real interesting point, with no breathing, and no brain damage. You come out and you're fine. So something really extraordinary happens to the subtle, to subtle body, subtle physiology. But even again, we need to keep to the gold standard here because there's a lot of watering down nowadays. In fact, more normal to water down, to dilute, and therefore distort these than otherwise. I watch the popular literature and it's so disappointing. People are generally interpreting down to make the scriptures conform to their own experience. Say, I've experienced this, yeah, this is the first jhana, and they dumb it down. It happens all over the place. So the gold standard is, and the gold standard in the Theravada and the Tibetan is the same. So there's no sectarianism here, but I'm really holding to the gold standard, right? And the gold standard is if you've achieved shamatha, just shamatha, which is threshold to the first jhana, not the actual state, but right on the threshold. As His Holiness and many, many other yogis say, oh, then you can slip effortlessly into samadhi, remain there for 4 hours, no sweat. It just balanced, luminous, blissful, non-conceptual awareness withdrawn from the senses. And so, of course, the coarse mind is dissolved into the substrate consciousness, and you're simply aware of the substrate. 4 hours, easy, right? If you've achieved the actual state of the first jhana, now this comes from the Theravada tradition, from Buddhaghosa. He's about as authoritative as it gets after the Buddha and after, you know, his immediate disciples. If you've achieved the actual state of the first jhana, then you should have no problem going into samadhi and remaining in flawless samadhi, unbrokenly, for 24 hours. Effortlessly. And Buddhaghosa says, like a strong man who can remain standing for 24 hours at a stretch. So a lot of people nowadays are saying, oh yeah, I went on this one retreat, I achieved the first jhana. There's one guy from California, of course, and he leads jhana weekend retreats, you know. And so, you know, people go on a weekend retreat with him, and then at the end, how many jhanas did you achieve? You know, so it's, I won't say anything more, I'll get very sarcastic very quickly. You know, but this is the gold standard, this is the real one. And it's rather rare to see people accomplish this, and it's extremely common to see people completely blow it. So that's a fourth. So the fourth stabilization is endowed with equanimity. The way to cultivate these four jhanas and the characteristics and benefits of them are stated by the Lord, that is the Buddha, in the Perfection of Wisdom Sutra in 25,000 stanzas. So Subhuti, Rapchor in Tibetan. Subhuti, so this is a Buddha speaking here in this Mahayana Sutra. Bodhisattvas, the great beings, dwell in the perfection of jhana, isolated from desires and isolated from evil, non-virtuous things, endowed with investigation and analysis, and imbued with well-being and joy. Born of isolation, that is, born of isolation means it's not stimulus-driven. That's exactly what it means. It's withdrawn from all the bounties, the pleasurable stimulations of the desire realm. Therefore, this is not hedonic. Hedonic is stimulus driven. This is not stimulus driven. This is coming from the balance of your own mind. Born from isolation, they've achieved the first jhana and dwell therein. Having calmed investigation and analysis, their minds become completely lucid. And due to the unification of their mind stream, they are imbued with well-being and joy that arises from samadhi that is free of investigation and analysis. They accomplish the second jhana and dwell therein. Moving right on. Freeing themselves, and by the way, this is very much in accord. I mean, frankly, it's exactly in accord with the Pali Canon of the Theravada. There's just no difference. Slight difference of translation is about it, but that I can easily explain. So, freeing themselves from attachment to what sense of pleasure? Acha. Okay, pleasure I was translating here as, this is the gawa, or pritti. So pleasure, the other one, so it's pleasure and well-being, pleasure and well-being. What you're transcending now is the pleasure. Am I getting that right? I don't want to blow it. No, this one is the sense of well-being. So what I was translating here as pleasure is actually well-being, sukha. So you got rid of joy, pritti, in the third jhana. I'm getting it. In the second jhana, you have well-being and joy. Third jhana, you have well-being, but you've transcended joy. Okay? You have sukha, but you've transcended joy. Freeing themselves from attachment to joy, to pleasure, endowed with mindfulness and dwelling in introspection and equanimity, they experience physical joy and possess the mindfulness of the Aryas. Living in a state called equanimity, they accomplish the third stabilization, free of pleasure, and dwell therein. So this is what I was calling here, because it's been 20 years since I translated it, and the terminology I use is a bit different now. But living in joy, this is sukha. This is sukha. And the pleasure was pritti, or pleasure is good. But here, joy, it's really more of a sense of well-being. Because you can see it's subtler. It's subtler than the pleasure. Okay, that's why in this one there's no pleasure, but there is joy. Okay, well-being. And then finally, the fourth one. Abandoning well-being as well as suffering, sukha and dukkha, mental pleasure and displeasure are overcome even more than before. Due to the absence of both joy and suffering, they accomplish the fourth jhana, in which equanimity and mindfulness are fully purified and they dwell therein. So there are the four jhanas. These are all in the form realm. A lot could be said about that, but we need to keep moving here. It's subtler realm. It's always present. It is where we are right now. And it is said in Buddhist cosmogony, that is the formation of worlds, that the desire realm emerges from the form realm. And in periods of great distraction, the desire realm is reduced back to the form realm. So, moreover, these great beings, the Mahasattvas, they do not grasp at the characteristics of dhyana and its attributes, these great beings, because if you just grasp at them, you're stuck, right? And just by the way, this is called the mundane path of vipassana. This is called vipassana, because there is an investigation there. There is a movement from coarse to subtle, coarser, subtler and subtler and subtler. It is mundane, jikdembe hlaktong, mundane vipassana. But it's a mundane because it's not taking you out of samsara, it's just taking you to subtler places in samsara. So therefore, they do not grasp at the characteristics of dhyana and its attributes. Due to being endowed with minds of such meditative equipoise, they experience numerous types of paranormal abilities. These are siddhis, or miraculous abilities, paranormal. They're better paranormal. They're not miraculous, as if you're getting something from the divine, from God, and so forth. They're paranormal, and I would say exactly in the same way that a laser is paranormal light. It's not magical light, it's not miraculous light, but if you're living in the 19th century, it would look like it. You say, it must be an angel, it must be God, it must be magic. Yeah, well, sufficiently highly developed technology to a person who doesn't understand it looks like magic. I would say in Buddhism there is no such thing as magic. I don't really think there's anything such a thing as miracles, because they all have a rational explanation relative to context. Right. I mean, it's all laid out. I mean, this is how you do it. In Christianity, they don't tell you this is how you perform a miracle. A miracle is a supernatural intervention, right? Which created real havoc in the 17th century when they're trying to get an orderly universe, all these devout Christians, and then they said, what do we do with God and miracles? It's an interesting story. That could take us for the next hour, but not right now. But you see, they really had a dilemma, because these are really devout Christians, Newton and the whole company, and they really believed in miracles, but if God can intervene anytime he likes, healing people and turning water into wine and etc., then how can you take any of your laws seriously? It's just because he'll break them any time. So you see, it was not a trivial issue. He came up with a very ingenious way of dealing with that. Stupid, but ingenious. Okay, so what are these paranormal abilities you can develop just through developing the jhanas? Such people, they can even cause the earth to quake. Just what we need in California. Bring them on. They can transform to one to many. So just think about a lucid dream. This is the easiest way to think of this, right? Think about in a lucid dream. You're very lucid. Could you, in a lucid dream, cause an earthquake? Sure. Just think quakey, earthy thoughts. You know, designate earthquake and it starts to rumble. Could you? And this is actually explicitly a practice you are trained to do. In kind of the second phase of dream yoga, transform one to many. So if you have one form, make a replica. If you're looking at one plant, turn it into two, right? If you're looking at one Marilyn Monroe, make another one. More the merrier. And so they transform from one to many, they transform from many to one. So the same thing, inversely, you're just kind of playing with it. Because after all, both in the Prajnaparamita and in a lucid dream, there's nothing there objectively real anyway. So there is no objective resistance. There's no reality saying, I don't think so. There's nothing there. If you've realized that emptiness, and these are mahasattvas doing this, maybe that's a key. These are mahasattvas, these are bodhisattvas doing this. And it's in the context of perfection of wisdom. So maybe they've got some understanding of insight, of emptiness, and that's supercharging their jhana practice. So they can transform from many to one. They experience becoming invisible, visible and invisible. That would be interesting. They pass through walls. I often give that exercise to students of mine who are getting pretty good at dream yoga. You know, there's the wall, walk through it. I don't know how many of them are still stuck. You know? This is why I don't have more students in retreat. So pass through walls, they pass through fences, and they pass through fences. So Donald Trump wants to build a great big wall between Mexico and America. You know, should teach all the Mexicans the jhanas, you know, and they can flip on the bird as they walk right through. Hey Trump, here's to you. We trumped you. Ha ha. So they pass unimpededly through mountains like birds in the sky. They also move through space like birds. Cool. They rise up and penetrate down through the earth as if they were moving in water, and they walk on water without sinking. That sounds very interesting. So, we need to get these contemplative observatories coming up, you know. I mean, this is either true or false. But that means you have to achieve those jhanas. This is the thing about it. It's not pray really, really hard and maybe you'll get a boon, a siddhi, you know, a miraculous zap. Just do the technology. Do the technology. That's what it says. Such characteristics and benefits are extensively discussed. And frankly, this is all homogenous. That is, in the Pali Canon, they refer to the same type of siddhis. This is no more flamboyant or extraordinary or amazing than what you find in the Pali Canon and the Theravada. But the Theravada doesn't have the perfection of wisdom. So it actually is much more arduous. To achieve this, Buddhaghosa suggests you should achieve all the four jhanas and the four samapatis in the formless realm, and you should exercise extensively in all of them. He tells exactly how to do it in Visuddhimagga, the path of purification. But this is supercharged with insight into emptiness. We know that. We should know that by context. This is a Prajnaparamita Sutra. So it seems to be, well, it clearly does. It augments the power of your samadhi by having it supercharged with insight into emptiness. The glorious Tukluk Tengwa, so one of the great siddhas, and I think this is from the Purbarwa. So this would be one of the great Kagyu masters, Mahamudra masters. So he writes, and I'm going to have to linger here because there's something very interesting coming up. Okay, due to the 9 methods for sustaining attention presented generally in the sutras, one first accomplishes single-pointed quiescence of the desire realm. Okay, that is very technical, but it's worth lingering. If you want to understand the text, let's really understand it and not just gloss over the hard parts. I checked this to make sure that I would pass on something accurate, and I'm now very confident what I'm about to say is spot on. When you see, due to the 9 methods for sustaining attention, it will be very easy for those of you with a Tibetan Buddhist background to think, oh yeah, got it, 9 stages leading to shamatha. Wrong. Completely wrong. Wildly wrong. Okay, not that. So I checked. Because it looks like it, but it's not. 9 stages, so I checked it out, and here's what it is. 9 stages, he's referring to 9 dhyanas. So the first 4 dhyanas we've just checked out, okay, in brief, and you can read all kinds of this, all a lot of good literature out about it. The first, second, third, fourth dhyana in the form realm. And then we have these 4 dhyanas, they're more commonly called samapatis or absorptions, in the formless realm. They go from limit in sequence, from coarse to subtle. It's the same trajectory, all coarse to subtle, 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 subtle. So the first samapati, or you can also call it jhana, in the formless realm is called limitless space. It doesn't really tell you a whole lot, but that's kind of the gist of it. The experience is one of limitless space, which means you've transcended all forms, even subtle forms. Hence, formless realm versus form realm. And then you find that relatively coarse, and you move to a subtler absorption, which is limitless consciousness, not to be mistaken at all for omniscience. It's just a sense of boundless consciousness. You find even that relatively coarse, so you move into a subtler absorption called the absorption in nothingness, jiyamepa, nothingness. It's hard to imagine, but you find that coarse. And you move into the fourth one, which is called neither, it's often called perception, I don't think it's a good translation, neither discernment nor non-discernment. It's just, don't try to wrap your conceptual mind around this because you're not going to get it. Because you'll think, okay, do you really know something? Do you ascertain something or not? So, well, never mind, just hush. And if you're really curious, achieve it for yourself and then you'll know. So this, in the Indo-Tibetan tradition, that fourth absorption in the formless realm is called sipetsemo, the peak of cyclic existence, the peak of mundane existence. It's as high as you get in samsara. Extremely rarefied, extremely abstract, it feels like it will go on forever and it doesn't. Okay, but that's only 8. There's another one, and it's accepted both in the Pali Canon, let's say in the Shravaka teachings, as well as the Mahayana. And it's called in Tibetan Gokpe Nyomchuk. Gokpe Nyomchuk. It is the absorption into cessation. Absorption in cessation. Or Nirodha Samapati. So I checked that one out. I learned more about it, actually. I was never particularly interested. I got interested because I wanted to understand this. And this, so I'm going to try to be brief, but you know, if we're going to have a complete commentary, here, let's have a complete commentary. So this is the 9th jhana. It's achieved only within the Theravada. I'm just going to speak of it within the Theravada context. To try to go into Mahayana just gets too complicated, not very useful right now. But baseline, this is something emphasized in the Theravada context. It's in the Pali Canon. And so this is achievable only by people who are either non-returners or arhats. So when you first achieve the Arya path on the Sravakayana, you become a stream enter, then a once-returner, then a non-returner, and then an arhat, right? You have to be on one of the 2 highest levels. In other words, you've already realized nirvana deeply, right? But now, not only must you either be a non-returner or an arhat, but you must also have realized all of the the lower eight jhanas. You have to go through all of them. But not only have gone through all of them as a mundane path, but within the Shravaka, Nyentuki Tekpa, within the Shravaka context, you must be actually following that trajectory, and for each one, you must investigate the first jhana, the second, third, each one you investigate to realize its aspects of midatungadame, of impermanence, unsatisfactoriness, and non-self. Each one you identify that. So you're applying the core Vipassana insights of the Shravakayana to each of the four jhanas. And just do it over and over and over again, all the way up to the culminating, this highest state in the formless realm, this neither discernment nor non-discernment. You realize it, you realize its nature is impermanent, unsatisfactory, or unsatisfying, and identityless. And then having realized all of that, then something really odd happens. And that is you slip into a state called cessation, nirodha, cessation. You get a real taste of death, but this is not a type of spiritual euthanasia. You're not killing yourself, right? But internally you kind of have. So there was a passage, I just read it, a very technical article, it was good, showing what's the difference between this and death. And the death was, well, it's irreversible. That is, you lose your body heat, you lose your vitality, and then there's no coming back. You're finished. This one, that the pilot light remains on, but outwardly you look dead as a doornail. And your mind, but most importantly, your mind has ceased. It's called cessation for a reason. You slip into a state literally of unknowing. Manifestly from your side, it's a termination of consciousness. Now, it's not irreversible, because you can come out of this and go and have a cup of tea and walk around, right? But while you're there, it's a really deep termination. And that's what they say. Now, you don't need to achieve this to become an arhat, but this is something that one can achieve in this lifetime. But then, of course, you can come out of that samapati, and then you can walk around and your mind is activated again. So I thought about this. So what I've just told you is, I read, I understood, I've just narrated what I read. Okay. But I thought of some, I think, quite interesting parallels. So now I want to be very clear. I'm about to give an interpretation based upon some of my studies and practice and so forth, but clearly I can be totally off base. Okay. But right now I don't think so. I'm going to draw an analogy first. In fact, right now is the time to unpack a little bit. This brilliant, I think truly brilliant, account of four types of mindfulness on the path of settling the mind in its natural state from Dujum Lingpa. I've taught them a number of times, but not here. So we're going to do it fairly quickly. Okay? You'll remember in the practice of settling the mind in its natural state, you crack the door open. How do you know when you're getting it? The gears are meshing. You're actually doing the practice correctly. You need to remember this. You're able to distinguish experientially the difference between stillness and motion. Remember? That's it. You don't get that, forget about it. Because what this means is whenever a thought comes up and it's moving, you're in movement too. And then the thought stops, and then you stop. Then the thought comes up, and you're in movement. In other words, it's cognitive fusion. With desires, emotions, thoughts, memories, the mind moves, you're just moving all over the place. The mind is the car, you're the poor dog, you know, roped to the back of the car. You're just moving whenever the car moves, right? So then that means you're just having a wandering mind. It's rumination. You're an ordinary person. But we're cultivating here the ability of stillness and to be able to observe motion, right? And recognize, aha, my awareness is still, but the mind is in motion. That's the first step, right? Now, we have four types of mindfulness. This is straight from Shidik Dorje Nyumbu Gyu, one of the five treatises on Dzogchen by Dujum Lingpa. The Sharp Vajra of Conscious Awareness Tantra, the first mindfulness is single-pointed mindfulness. This is where you are simultaneously aware of the stillness of your awareness and the movements of the mind. Literally simultaneous. Acquaint yourself with that. Go deeper in that. And you achieve manifest mindfulness. Ngungyurki Tenpa. Se Chikpe Tenpa, Ngungyurki Tenpa. Manifest mindfulness. And this is where you're in flow. It's not qualitatively different, except for now it's more effortless. You get into, you're streaming. It's a nice term. You're streaming. You're the kestrel, still, and motion, and still, motion. You got into the groove of it. You're like a marathon runner who's caught your second wind, and you're there for the long haul. And that's manifest mindfulness. Bear in mind, mindfulness means bearing in mind. You're holding your act together, right? That's the second one. Third one is an interesting one. And this has spooked a lot of good meditators in Tibet and probably elsewhere. Because what's happening here, as you are now in this flow, and it's a long flow, as you're going, let's say, from stage 4 to stage 9 out of the 9 stages preceding the actual state of shamatha, well, that's all stage 4. That's all this manifest mindfulness. It's cruising altitude. There you are, cruising along. Less and less activity is arising in the mind. The mind is getting more and more stable. The clarity is getting better. You achieve stage 9. And then your coarse mind is finally, it's out of gas. And it goes, It goes dormant. You're going to get it back, but it goes dormant. The coarse mind goes dormant, and together with the coarse mind going dormant, all of the concomitant mental processes also go dormant. You can't have one without the other. So the coarse mind has now gone dormant. It's no longer active, which means your mindfulness as a mental factor of the coarse mind has just vanished, which means the fourth type of mindfulness is the mindfulness of the absence of mindfulness. Because the mindfulness that was a mental factor of the coarse mind has stopped, together with all the rest of them. But now imagine, and you can. You can do not a bad approximation, I think. Imagine now that you're really very, very well trained in this manifest mindfulness, and you're focused single-pointedly on the space of the mind, whatever comes up, and it's getting less and less and less and less. The mind is becoming calmer. Your senses are now all withdrawing into the mental. Your eyes are open, you don't see. You don't experience your body, you don't experience the environment. Your mind is radiantly clear, and all of the light of your awareness is now single-pointedly focused on the space of the mind, and there's nothing there. You're not bearing anything in mind. There's no mindfulness. But you're kind of like in a dark room. And what you're attending to is an absence of appearances. And therefore, it's an absence of mindfulness. So some people get there, or they get close and say, oh, no, and they're pulling back. Like, that's death. You know? It's a pretty good approximation of death. But Dujum Lingpa, so my voice doesn't count. There's no Alan Wallace here at all. My voice doesn't count. I'm speaking of Dujum Lingpa, right? His voice counts. He achieved all of this. He says, now what do you do? Now you must move to the fourth mindfulness. And this is self-illuminating mindfulness. Now we know by the term, what are you doing at this point? You were focusing in that absence of mindfulness, focusing the light of your awareness into a vacuity, which means nothing's illuminated. There's no appearances. It's like shining a bright light into empty space. And you, if you're looking at empty space, and whether it's filled with light or it has no light, there's no difference. Because it's nothing to reflect on. Right? So what do you do then? You invert your light back in upon itself. You invert your awareness, which we've already been doing an awareness of awareness. You invert your awareness right in upon itself. And now it's self-illuminating mindfulness. Congratulations, you have now fully achieved shamatha. But for a little while there, it looked spooky that you just basically committed, you know, suicide. You just blotted your mind out because the only mind you were familiar with was the coarse mind, and it terminated. It looked like death really is termination. Death is the end, you know. Until you do that Mahamudra Dzogchen trick, you turn it in upon itself. Now, they don't do that in Theravada. I've not seen any reference to doing that. So they too, of course, many of the great Theravada masters, of course, they've nailed the first jhana. And they also have term for threshold to the first jhana. What happens when you achieve, you cross the threshold into the first jhana, is the coarse mind, they call it javana, the activities of the mind, they all go dormant. Well, activities of the court, now we're going to use Mayandra terminology, the activities of the coarse mind all go dormant, as if you've just fallen deep asleep. And all that remains is the bhavanga. The bhavanga is exactly that dimension of consciousness that lingers in deep, dreamless sleep when you don't know anything at all. You get there. But as far as I can tell, that's the absence of mindfulness. They don't talk about inverting awareness and panasal. They say, hey, you got there with a sign, and that little counterpart sign flickered up, but you lost it. Get it back. Or start practicing vipassana. But don't stay there, because you're just, this is my interpretation, but I'm actually very confident about it. You've just achieved an absence of mindfulness. So don't just hang out there, stupid. Really, don't hang out there, stupid. Either move ahead and retrieve that very subtle counterpart sign and fully achieve the first jhana with a target, this extremely rarefied sama sign from the form realm, and then you can fully move into the domain of the first jhana and move fully into the form realm. That's good, and then you can go to the second, third, fourth jhana and knock yourself out. Or you can just remain in the threshold of the first jhana and start practicing vipassana. That's fine. But do something, stupid. Don't just rest on the bhavanga, because you're just sitting there in a dark room staring into the dark, right? They don't do this. I think that's a distinction. I'm not a great scholar of Theravada, but I have been looking at it for 45 years. I think I probably would have found it. I think something would have come up, because I've collaborated with some really good scholars. So that was a little introduction, this Dzogchen unpacking by Padmasambhava, by way of Dujum Lingpa. So you want to know the real source of that. That was those four mindfulness. That's Padmasambhava by way of Dujum Lingpa. Right? And it completely accords with Tsongkhapa, with Vasubandhu, with Asanga, and it accords with Buddhaghosa, except that they just do something Buddhaghosa didn't think about doing. But now this... So what's happened there? The lights all turn out in the coarse mind, but you haven't turned the lights on yet for the subtle mind until you have this self-illuminating mindfulness, right? Then you can rest there, and it's blissful, and it's luminous, and non-conceptual, right? Because it's self-illuminating. And by the way, you have crossed the threshold into the form realm. To achieve the threshold of the first jhana is you have accessed the form realm. It's a big deal, right? But now this mysterious one that is so far beyond anything I've experienced, but I try to use my intelligence. So what's that non-returner, that arhat, doing way up yonder, up on this neither discernment nor non-discernment, and then moves? Well, the mind you're working with in those jhanas, of course, is a subtle mind. It's not the coarse mind. That coarse mind belongs back here in the desire realm. So using that subtle mind through the jhanas into the formless realm, up to the very peak of the formless realm, what ceases? What goes dormant, inoperative, turned off when you achieve cessation? And it looks to me like there's really only, I like logic that leaves you only with one alternative at the end. I don't see any choice, because they've not realized Rigpa, there's no question of that. Nobody says that. But something terminated. Well, it's not the coarse mind, that was way back there. You know, way back there, miles back. The subtle mind. They turn off the light. It's like deep cosmic sleep. Deep cosmic sleep. That even the subtle mind has gone inactive. Dormant, not knowing. Right? So that's my interpretation. One, a much deeper reflection of the other. That's the ninth. That's the ninth one. So now you know. That's Nirodha Samapatti. The absorption into cessation. Let's see what else he says here. So, due to the nine methods for sustaining attention presented generally in the sutras, one first accomplishes a single-pointed shamatha of the desire realm. So this is just before you achieve shamatha. This is, I can tell you exactly what this is. And this is why this can be confusing. We mustn't be confused. The nine stages of semne rimbagu, the nine stages of attentional development, you know, culminating then in the very next stage in shamatha, accessed or threshold of the first jhana. That is Kadasaha. That is a samadhi in the desire realm, the ninth stage out of nine stages prior to shamatha. That's as good as it gets in the desire realm. But you haven't achieved shamatha yet. You've not achieved threshold of the first jhana. When you do that, you move from the desire realm to the form realm. You cross the threshold. But that ninth stage is pretty darn good. I mean, it's extremely good. You can effortlessly slip into samadhi, remain for hours, and come right out again, and you can do that whenever you like. It's just not shamatha. You haven't crossed the threshold. You're still in the desire realm. So there's complete concurrence here between the Theravada and the Mahayana and the Mahamudra Dzogchen. That kind of gives me confidence. So, upon accomplishing the fourth stabilization, the fourth jhana, clearly not the fourth attentional state, that's kid stuff, but accomplishing the fourth jhana, one achieves the five extrasensory perceptions resulting from the path of extrasensory perception. This is ngunshe, or abhijna in Sanskrit. So what are the five extrasensory perceptions? Now this is from achieving the fourth jhana. That's way beyond shamatha. Shamatha is access to the first jhana. But following the Prajnaparamita Sutra there, if you achieve all the four jhanas, he's simply corroborating what's said in the Prajnaparamita Sutra, you achieve five types of extrasensory perception, or abhijna. And these are, first of all, the first one is simply called dzuntul, or it's cities, it's these paranormal abilities. And we saw them walking in water, flying into the sky, and so forth, things that you can do if you're lucid in a dream. Okay, so that's the first one. The second one is clairaudience, the deva ear, but you can hear things that are miles or maybe hundreds of miles away. You're hearing them, but of course you're not hearing them with your eardrums. You're hearing them with mental awareness, but you are hearing sounds. Now, one of the weirdest things that kind of gives, I mean, I believe it already. I have a lot of confidence in this tradition. But one of the weirdest things coming out of research by people like Bruce Grayson, whom I met, know and respect, and other people, and there aren't many, but people doing this research in near-death experiences. And I've corresponded with Bruce Grayson. He came to a conference that Tony Karam and I invited him to. One of the weirdest things about people having these out-of-body experiences when their heart and brain have stopped temporarily for a couple of minutes is that they can be in the operating room and they can hear things that are going on in the operating room and their brain is flatlined. So their ears are not operating. They're not picking up sound waves hitting the eardrum. Their auditory cortices are not operating and they're hearing anyway. And of course they're seeing also. They're seeing colors. They're seeing people. They're seeing and hearing things that other people are seeing and hearing. So it's not a hallucination. It's not a false memory. They're seeing it. They're seeing and hearing, but their eyes are closed. The visual cortex is shut down. Their ears are plugged, and they're still seeing and hearing. They're seeing and hearing with mental consciousness. And one woman who has the pseudonym of Pat Reynolds, who had this experience, she reported, and it was on a National Geographic documentary, which is not known as flaky. National Geographic documentary, I watched it. And she was interviewed years after this experience where she was temporarily killed by the doctor so they could do a very, very complex and subtle surgery deep inside her brain to fix an aneurysm. They had to cool her down to about 60 degrees Fahrenheit. Otherwise, they'd do much too much damage to the brain. She had an extremely vivid out-of-body experience where she veridically observed things taking place in the operating room. What I found interesting, she's not alone, but this is one of the more compelling accounts of that. The doctor said afterwards, she knew things that she had no business knowing. That's what the doctor said, okay? Not some flaky new age guy on the outside. The doctor said she shouldn't have known, and he said, it's interesting. That's interesting. What's for dinner after all? What am I doing? What's for dinner? He didn't seem like, are you kidding me? No, that is interesting. What I found interesting in her account, this was something like, I don't know, 10, 12 years after the event. She's dead now, years later. She said, 10 or 12 years, something like that, after the event, she said, those remain some of my most vivid memories I've ever had in my life. The vividness, the hyper quality of it was so extraordinary. I can remember it like yesterday. This does not strike me as a false memory or just kind of like a vague hallucination, you know. Something exceptional. She's seeing and hearing with mental awareness alone. And so that's what this is. This, how do you say, clairaudience. You're hearing sounds, speech, and so forth. It can be hundreds of miles away. You're hearing it with mental awareness. Paranormal, mental awareness. Right? So that's the second one. Penetration of others' minds. Look out what you wish for. You actually are able to observe other people's thoughts, memories, and so forth. Okay. One of my teachers made that embarrassingly obvious that he could do that. Embarrassing to me. Recollection of past lives. That's one of them. Recollection of past lives. Okay, that would be good. And then clairvoyance. You're seeing things that are distant. Could be hundreds of miles of difference. One, Russell Targ, who's done the best research that I know of in the United States on this. This is called remote viewing in modern science. He spent years and millions of dollars of U.S. government money on researching this. And he's a physicist, a PhD in physics. I know him. I've known him for some years now. Straight, intelligent. He used to be getting funded by the CIA and the I want to say War Department, but we don't have a War Department. We have Defense Department, yeah. Defense Department. That's, the Americans defend themselves. We don't wage war, we just defend them. He got millions and millions of dollars over like 20 years through the Stanford Research Institute, SRI, to conduct this paranormal research. And what he found, based upon years and years of experience, is that he basically had to find gifted people, because he didn't have a training that could take you from scratch to really developing exceptional abilities. He had to, frankly, from a Buddhist perspective, he had to find people who had strong karma for that, had pretty good, how do you say, percentage of accuracy, up to 60% accuracy. But what he found was, when they given them a target, and he says, can you see this, can you see this, I found very interesting was, it didn't make any difference whether the target was 100 meters away, or 100 miles away, or 100 kilometers away. In other words, it wasn't like gravity where it goes off in an inverse square law. It didn't matter. That was quite interesting. That's what he found. And he said, I don't believe in paranormal abilities. The evidence is so compelling, I have no choice. And now he stopped doing that research and he's practicing Dzogchen. That's true. That's true. Yeah. So that's the clairvoyance. Okay? So these five types of abhijna, or existential perception, these are common to non-Buddhist adepts. In other words, these were developed long before the Buddha. The great yoga tradition of India and so forth. India is the mother of samadhi. Where you find samadhi, you find these. Whether it's in the Taoist tradition, the Christian tradition, the Sufi. Find a contemplative tradition that has really, really developed samadhi, you're going to find cities. I got to know a guy. I wish I knew how to contact him again. He was Muslim. He was Muslim, and he sought me out when I was teaching at UC Santa Barbara, University of California, Santa Barbara. By that time, I had published Choosing Reality. He'd read it. He liked it. He sought me out. Really interesting guy. He was a professor of physics, of atomic physics, in Baghdad and I think in Jordan, because he was from Jordan. He had a dual position. I think one was Jordan, the other one I remember was Baghdad. That gave me the creeps. I was, fearing for him. Because this was way back in 1997 or 8, so before the Gulf Wars. And that makes him interesting. So he's an atomic physicist that sought me out to talk about this. He was also an accomplished dervish. Accomplished dervish. And he was authorized by his master, a Sufi dervish, to share what he had accomplished in a scientific setting. And he was not a whirling dervish. Obviously, there seemed to be different kind of schools of the dervishes. The technique they would achieve would be, they would go into some meditative state. I have no idea what it was, but he had achieved it. And they would put something that looks for all the world like a knitting needle, a thick needle, through their one cheek, right through, and then through the other one, and so they're skewered. So I saw this in a video done in a laboratory at the University of Cincinnati, I think it was. Laboratory conditions by skeptics. And he got permission from his master to do this in this scientific objective setting and have it all filmed. And he first of all put this knitting needle through one cheek and through another. He showed about as much pain. You want to watch? Want to see what it looked like when he's doing this? Nothing. Not a wince. He gave no indication of any pains whatsoever. So he's skewered, and he leaves it, and normally they just put it in and take it out. But he wanted to demonstrate something for the scientific community. So they said, well, he said, what would you like to do to show this is not a trick, it's not sleight of hand, it's not an illusion, I really did stick a knitting needle through my cheeks. And so they said, we'll put you into the MRI, and we're going to scan your head with this knitting needle through your mouth. How do you fake that one? And they did. They put him in. They said, I don't know, 10 minutes in there to understand it as completely as they possibly could. And he came out, and yeah, he put a knitting needle through his mouth. He sure did. And they'd all had it filmed, all documented. And then, when they're all finished, okay, anything else you want to check? I think more, anything else you want to check? then he pulled it out. He pulled it out, and I saw it on film. And there was one little dab of blood, like one drop of blood here, and no drop on the other side at all, and the wounds healed, sealed right over. They just rip, and there was no scar, no hole, and one little drop of blood, gone. That's what I saw. I asked him, why did you do that? It's not really a marketable skill. And he had a phrase from, I don't know what language, but it was basically, just because. Just, do you know what the Arabic or Persian or Urdu might be? But it was kind of like, we just do it. We're playing. I mean, I could ask, you know, rugby players, why are you doing that? Especially if you're not professional. Okay, professional getting money. Okay, non-professional rugby players, why are you doing that? Yeah, come on. Come on, give me a reasonable answer. And it's kind of like, well, we like doing it. And that's why they do it. We like doing it. We like showing what we can do. What he told me, and why triggered this memory was, he told me when he was growing up in Jordan, very traditional village setting, he said they saw cities all the time. They were so commonplace that, you know, yeah, I mean, everybody knew. It's like, you know, what do you think? Do you think cell phones exist? I'm not quite sure. Because, you know, they say you can talk into them and hear people, that you develop clairvoyant abilities and actually, you know, clairaudience with a cell phone. I mean, it's so implausible. They don't really exist, do they? It would be kind of like asking, in his village, in his area, cities don't really exist, do they? Like, yeah, cell phones, and yeah, two different types of technology. So there we are. So non-Buddhist, Sufi, Taoist, Christian, Buddhist, wherever you find samadhi, you're going to find this. Where you don't find it is modern civilization that didn't even think about beginning to train attention until the 21st century, which is incredibly weird. These are common to non-Buddhist adepts and to the Buddhist sutras and tantras. In contrast, this shamatha, that is what's being discussed in this, in his text, Suklak Tengwa, and what's being discussed in this chapter, this shamatha, which is accomplished by means of the sequence of instructions of Mahamudra and so on, this chapter, this text, arises from essential points of practical teachings. In the very nature of single-pointed attention of the desire realm, there are qualities comparable to the four jhanas. And upon that basis, the jhanas of the divine abodes are achieved, form and formless realms. In other words, without having to achieve all the first, second, third, fourth, and all up, just by achieving like stage 9 in the desire realm, you can get a lot of those benefits. That's what he claims here. Then even without difficulty, one first achieves just a portion of shamatha as the basis of insight. That is, without fully achieving the first jhana, second, third, and fourth, and so forth. He says, actually, single-pointed attention in the desire realm, well, that would be all the way up to the 9th stage prior to shamatha. But one does not practice as if the mundane jhanas alone were the most important. That point just has to be made again and again and again and again. These are not made as ends in themselves. So this turns out to be a very, very interesting series of claims that we'll be investigating a bit more closely. But that was kind of a information-filled session. I find very interesting. But it's interesting, frankly, I mean, you see I'm passionately interested, but if and only if, we can be checking this out. if it's just something to memorize, so you tell your students and they tell their students, that's like, you know, everybody living in poverty telling stories about the good old days when people were wealthy. That would not be entertaining for me. You know, as you're eating a little tiny bit of gruel, thinking, oh, but it says in the old days they used to have vegetables. So this is interesting if you can actually do it. So for this, come on, Australia, you got a lot of empty land out there in the outback. No dearth of land. Let's see Contemplative Observatory, let's see, get the act together. And you Aussies, and I get your act together. You have only 23 million people in this country? That's not exactly overly crowded. We have more people in California. So there it is. That's it. Enjoy your evening. Hasta la vista.